Welcome to the Pursuit of Learning podcast. I'm your host, Clint Murphy. My goal is for each of us to grow personally, professionally, and financially, one conversation at a time. To do that, we will have conversations with subject matter experts across a variety of modalities. My job as your host will be to dig out those golden nuggets of wisdom that will facilitate our growth. Join me on this pursuit. Today, I had the pleasure of talking with Ian Perry, the Director of Performance for Capital Strength Training Systems in Ottawa. Ian works with high-level athletes across a number of sports. He also provides coaching and programming to the general public, remotely and in person. In this conversation, we talk about physical literacy, long-term athlete development, the importance of diet, sleep, hydration, and mobility on an athlete's recovery, and so much more. If you're interested in fitness and training, come along with me and learn through this conversation. Ian, welcome to the Pursuit of Learning. I want to dive right in with you today. You've been involved in fitness, whether in school, a professional coach or trainer, for a very long time, more than 10 years now. What got you started on the path of fitness?
Pretty general start for me. I mean, growing up, playing sports was definitely a big driver, and seeing the results associated with physical training and the application to sport and sports performance was a huge driver. Also, just mentors and people ahead of me who kind of paved that path for me. So a big one being my older brother, kind of showing me all assets of strength conditioning through the evolution of kind of bodybuilding to, you know, using a TRX for the first time, CrossFit, powerlifting, all those things. And then some just great mentors along the way that kind of pushed me in this direction.
The age gap between you and your brother that you're speaking about, who you were watching in the evolution of fitness, what's the age gap there for the two of you?
9 years, so quite substantial.
So you were able to see him performing at the high school level, at the college level, while you were still in elementary school, getting into high school.
Yeah, absolutely.
And speaking of university, when most kids are in university, during the summers, they either travel, take some time off, get a job at a restaurant as a server. You decided during your summer breaks that you were going to start a business, a training business. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. When I was at Queen's University doing an internship in strength conditioning, I was approached by a local high school coach who kind of floated out the idea that I should work with a couple of his athletes that he thought would really benefit from some strength conditioning work and specific football prep to get ready for the next level, to transition into the university levels. So he approached me, floated out the idea. I thought about it and I thought it'd be an awesome opportunity to take that, work with some younger kids, gain experience and kind of put myself out in that realm because it's much different than a collegiate setting. And I knew at some point that I'd have to mesh the two of them in case I didn't stay on that side of things. So I started working with those individuals and then through word of mouth and then through some affiliation with friends of mine who played at the collegiate level, hockey, football athletes, started this business kind of by accident and it ended up taking off. So it was awesome.
How many summers did you run the business for you?
4 summers and then my 5th summer transitioned into full-time employment.
And how did the business evolve over those years?
Yeah, so at first it was kind of one of these things where I was just helping out the high school. So this was kind of me just volunteering my time. And then as more interest picked up and there was more word of mouth and, you know, parents and other athletes asking like, hey, how do I get in? How do I get involved? I ended up talking to the school board and renting out their space, which was essentially a classroom, an old classroom converted into a weight room. Not a ton of equipment, but a whole set of dumbbells, a couple barbells, 1 squat rack. But fortunately for us, and an awesome experience with training athletes, like we had access to a gymnasium, a track, and a parking lot, as well as a hill. So it kind of gave us a bunch of different avenues to explore the different domains of athletic training. Yeah, it ended up being a great thing and a great learning experience.
And what were some of the biggest lessons learned from you in terms of fitness programming and also in terms of managing the young athletes and, might I say, their parents?
Yeah, so like I mentioned before, like the collegiate strength setting is much different than the private setting. So the collegiate setting, everyone's there, there's expectations set, you know, some of them are being paid, quote unquote, in some way to be there or supported financially. So they have a lot of buy-in from day one. So building a culture and reputation takes time and a lot of consistent effort in the private setting, because you aren't only catering to athletes, but you're also catering to outside coaches, and the big one, catering to parents as well and their expectations. So for me, it was kind of tying in what I knew from the collegiate setting and bringing it to that private setting, and also learning how to deal with youth athletes who might not be motivated by themselves to be there, and getting them to build an appreciation and a love for being in the weight room and creating a habit through repetition and constant effort. And as well as like the education piece, right? In a collegiate setting, like these kids have had some background or some exposure to strength conditioning before in some capacity. But with the youth athletes, like it might be their first time stepping into a weight room. It might be something that they really don't want to do. Or, you know, they've had experiences before that have been either negative or too much for them at their current level physically. And so it kind of brought out the idea of long-term athlete development being vital to the success of the business in aiming to train these youth athletes and to provide them with like a safe and encouraging space to get better.
Long-term athlete development, I want to come back to that. But for you personally, did that also mean, for the first time working with athletes, you had to start to develop skills as a motivator, because some of these younger athletes, as you said, might not have come with that inherent motivation and discipline that your collegiate athletes already had?
Yeah, I mean, at that age, you know, I had athletes as young as 11 and 12 years old coming in. And when you're not used to working with that level of athlete, you start to realize that, you know, you need to make training fun. You need to provide a less structured route of programming for them that allows you to tie in the fundamentals of strength conditioning, but also tie in like games and different, you know, providing different levels of leadership within the group. And, you know, okay, we led this warm up before. Do you as an athlete think that you can lead your group through a warm up? And like, what do you guys like? And so, you know, it ended up being a lot of back and forth between the athlete and the coach and finding what works best for them. Whereas in the collegiate setting, it's very straightforward. You have your program, it's up on, you know, the iPad or the Excel sheet, and we're going off that, and everyone just gets there and gets to work. This was much more about building relationships and, you know, dealing with all the issues that young athletes have, whether, you know, it's body image issues, confidence issues, all these types of things that come into play that you don't really have to deal with as much as a collegiate strength coach. So there is definitely a lot of relationship building and a lot of building trust with athletes and trying to figure out, you know, who's an introvert, who's an extrovert, who responds well to being pushed, who needs more detailed explanation, who needs a visual explanation. All these things come down to providing better cues for the athletes, putting them in a better and safer position, and making them feel comfortable with the service you're providing as a coach, because it definitely is a position of power. And I think sometimes people overlook that. So they're kind of treating the group like a spreadsheet rather than treating each person like an individual.
That's very valuable. And as a person who's getting involved in youth coaching for the first time, something that can be extremely important. So looking at each of the children on a team and saying, how does each of these children respond to motivation? What drives them? What makes them tick? What will get the best out of each of them individually versus what would normally get the best out of me, and applying that to 15 kids on a hockey team as an example.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one of those things where the scientific side to strength conditioning, like, it's so program based and so systems based, but there's a huge side of it. And again, it's constantly evolving, and there's much more resources out now and educational pieces on it. But like the motivational side to coaching, how to deliver appropriate cues for specific athletes. So those are the things that aren't really taught, and you kind of have to go out and find that yourself, how to be a good communicator, how to manage expectations, all these things besides just programming and marketing and selling.
And one of the things you talked about there was long-term athlete development. And what does that mean to our listeners so they're aware?
The sports side aside, if we're looking from a strength conditioning perspective and through the lens of a strength coach, it's getting an athlete when they're young and making training fun for the first time. So as a first exposure to some type of physical conditioning, you know, making sure that we are covering the basis of physical literacy for the athlete through their development, but not pushing it so far that we're applying principles. And we see it all too often where coaches are applying principles and methods that they would use with professional athletes or adults to children because it seems to look best to parents as a marketing ploy. So from my lens, it looks like getting a kid to buy into training in some way and making it fun so that their first exposure is not their last exposure to it. So making it something that they want to continue to do and always looking at it as an evolution. I've made this comparison before, but we wouldn't dive into organic chemistry before mastering the basics of science in elementary school and then progressing and, you know, covering all the sciences as a whole and then progressing grade 9, grade 10, grade 11, grade 12. There's always more and more, and there's always layers to it, just like this in terms of physical development and athletic development as a whole. So when we break it down, we're looking at fundamental movement patterns that apply to children, that apply to adults, but really starting it at a grassroots level and progressing as the athlete is able to be competent in certain positions and master the physical literacy and skill work step by step in order to get them to a level that, you know, we're really pushing their available performance capabilities, but always in a safe environment.
So something you mentioned there a couple times was physical literacy. For our listeners who might not be as aware, what is physical literacy?
So we're trying to open this big movement library to athletes. We're trying to expose them to a bunch of different things. If you look at the literature, and I'm sure a lot of parents listening or coaches listening are well aware, there's a ton of literature out about not specializing too early in sport, with those certain sports aside that are a little bit earlier specialization sports, swimming, gymnastics, etc. But exposing them to as much movement as possible. So, you know, can they run? Can they shuffle? Can they skip? Can they jump on one leg? Can they jump on two legs? Can they jump forward? Can they jump laterally? All these things. Can they squat? Can they lunge? Can they stand on one leg? So looking at different things, strength capabilities, spatial awareness capabilities, their ability to relate themselves in different situational environments where, you know, different visual cues are changing or where you're getting them to think while completing a drill. And all these things evolve over time. So you can start to add more and more to the equation as they become more comfortable with the basics. And that's the biggest thing that we teach in our facility is that, like, when we get you, and I said it before, we don't want it to be your last exposure to strength conditioning. If you had a really bad experience or a coach that was pushing too much on you too soon or too hard too soon, you're not going to enjoy being in the weight room. And the goal of long-term athlete development is that no matter where they start, if they decide to go in the competitive route, great. If they decide to go in the kind of non-competitive route, even better. But if they can continue to love and appreciate the process of training, then you now have adults who are continuing to train and continuing to take care of their body. And those adults at some point can be great coaches, can be great ambassadors for sport or physical training, strength coaches, physiotherapists, and whatnot. And it really becomes important in fostering a positive environment and creating that hierarchy through physical literacy so that, everyone's experience within this realm is awesome. And it creates a healthier population as a whole.
So a couple of key things that I want to dive into on what you just said. You talked a bit about not specializing too early. And being in a country where I see, as an example, a lot of parents are really gunning for their children to be in the NHL when they're 8 and 9 years old. Maybe it's a little too early at that stage. So two questions that come out of that for me. One, what do you recommend for parents with young children in terms of overall physical literacy to start to get them ready, let's say when they're 4, 5, 6 years old? And then when would you suggest to a parent or even to a child athlete that they actually start to think about specializing?
Yeah. So at a young age, I think getting them exposed to as much play and fun as possible. So whether that's, gymnastics, field sports, an amalgamation of different field sports, swimming is great, martial arts, dance, all these things that are incorporating, a bunch of different movement styles, different movement patterns, ingraining different motor skills and combining, a lot of coordination, a lot of power work, a lot of proprioceptive work, balance work. All these things are awesome and great full body exposures for these athletes. But when you look at the key theme to those things like dance, gymnastics, martial arts at a young age, it's that everything is so unstructured and they just allow the kids to play and have fun. They introduce certain techniques, certain skills along the way, but it's very free flowing and allows the athletes to kind of show you as a coach what they're capable of. And then as they get a little older from a programming standpoint, you can start to look at these different nuances that each athlete kind of portrays in these unstructured environments and start to say like, okay, I think we need to add a little bit of this and we are going to program it specifically so that maybe we can, get them in a better position, or maybe they have a really hard time catching a ball, or maybe they have a really hard time changing direction, whatever it may be. From a physical standpoint, you are kind of pinpointing these small little changes, which is going to be their first exposure to some type of structured training plan. But I think as they're young, just letting them have fun and express themselves physically and sitting back as a bystander to watch what they can do will be great. And it's also awesome to allow the athlete without interjecting too much. It's awesome to see their development through just, being confident in themselves to do all these things rather than, you're doing this wrong, you're doing this wrong. This is what it should like. This is what it should look like. A young child does not really respond well to that type of work and that type of feedback and criticism. In terms of specializing, I think if you can play as many sports as possible, not barring the exemptions of those athletes that are, really injured or beat up, but pulling athletes back and focusing on, two or three sports at one time into the, grade 10, grade 11 range, I think you're going to see athletes that are better rounded athletes, like well-rounded athletes, and who are able to express themselves physically in multiple domains really, really well without the possible burnout that comes along with specializing too early and really putting too much stress in one dimension into an athlete when they're not able to handle it physically, mentally, neurologically. Like, there's a lot of bad adaptations that come along with specializing too early. So I think the longer that you can do it and be exposed to different stimuli, the better.
Let's jump back forward in time now. You're at Queen's University, and while you were there, you were interning in the strength and conditioning program with a focus on men's hockey and football. Were these programs that were selected for you, or were they a personal choice? And if a personal choice, why did you choose football and hockey?
So in your first year of the internship program, they kind of expose you to every sport. So, you know, you show up to women's volleyball, you show up to men's football, you show up to a track workout. All these different exposures kind of give you an idea of the different types of programming styles, coaching styles available. And, you know, you start to see the way that you interact with one team is not how you interact with another. And the way that you motivate certain sections of a team, like say football, the way that the running backs are coached is much different from the way that the offensive line is coached. And you start to see all these different patterns, and it gives you an idea of like where you may want to be. So I was exposed to quite a bit, but I took a pretty heavy dive in with men's football and men's hockey. And then you have a end of year meeting with the head strength coach at the time. And you kind of talk about things you did really well throughout the year, things that you feel, you know, you need to work on. And you kind of talk about where your future lies within the program. And, you know, Rodney Wilson at the time at Queens, him and I sat down, had a really awesome chat about some pros and cons and things that went really well, things that didn't go well. And we decided that those were the two programs that I would do best with. And I did work with a couple other teams while I was there, but in a more limited capacity. And it ended up being a really awesome experience for me with both teams and with a lot of success with both clubs.
And then as you work through with the club, Ian, in what role and responsibility do you have, and that, how does that evolve as you go through your years at Queens?
Yeah, so in your second year, you know, you're kind of dealing with two teams, but you still have exposures and labs with, you know, other teams, especially when they're trying to focus on something specific to try to teach the interns. So say they were having an Olympic lifting session with the football team, you have an Olympic lifting coach that's in there that's explaining stuff. You also have more senior interns that are there explaining the nuances behind that as a subsection of training. So you have that, and you still have a lot of exposure, but again, you kind of like the long-term athlete development model, you are slowly specializing, but still fairly unstructured. In your third year, you are now kind of like a co-lead. So you're working with another third year intern. So with men's hockey, I was working with Doug Davidson, who's now the head strength coach for the Vegas Golden Knights. And him and I were responsible for programming, bouncing ideas off each other, presenting the program to the head strength coach of the school, and then him giving it the okay or him reworking a couple of things. On the football side, a physiotherapist that we know quite well, Dave Leland, was kind of my mentor in that regard. And Dave and I were responsible for programming for the football team, but also programming for a select subsection of athletes that would be trying to participate in the CFL draft. So kind of more combine training. And that was a really valuable experience. And that goes to show you kind of a more specialized niche of training. And then in my fourth year, you are now the lead strength coach for one of those teams. And you put a lot of your time into taking care of specific players, you know, providing more specific programming for certain athletes that may need it, whether there's an injury history or, you know, a new recruit that's coming in that needs a workout, you're kind of responsible for that. So it was really, really neat and kind of prepares you really well for the next level, which will be your first exposure to, you know, leaving school and working full time.
You mentioned Dave Leland, and that brought up an interesting observation for me. In your pursuit of all of these different training styles and working with athletes of different backgrounds, does that drive you as an individual to try a lot of different things? And why I thought of that as I thought of Dave is a physiotherapist who has very ambitious powerlifting goals. And then at the same time says, even while I'm focusing on these powerlifting goals, I'm going to do an Ironman. And so just a very interesting individual, and it escaped my mind that you two work together in the program. I'd forgotten that.
Yeah, Dave's incredible, man. He's one of those guys where, you know, I want a 500-pound deadlift. I want to be able to bench 315, but I also want to be able to run incredible distances. So yeah, it's, you know, you meet a lot of very interesting people in strength conditioning who are very, very bright, but have very different goals in terms of their own training styles. I mean, one of my other biggest mentors, Paul O'Need, who ended up being the head strength conditioning coach at Queens after Rodney and Dave left, is a professional powerlifter. So what I learned from him, you know, really helped me dealing with some of the athletes and some of the general public that I now train when it comes to breaking down the big lifts. Myself, it kind of pushed me into trying everything. You know, I've loved the whole science behind bodybuilding for a very long time and implemented a lot into my training, and think that there's a great deal that we can learn from that subsection of athletes and apply to the sports performance world. You know, they are the best athletes for putting on muscle and to adding structure to the body. So we can learn from that. It's forced me to dive into Olympic lifting. I spent quite a bit of time learning from Olympic lifting coach and trying to not really compete, you know, at a structured meet, but push myself and learn these methods. And then things like, I've done a strongman competition. I've dived into the literature and into different powerlifting programs. So I've also got into running at some point. So you take all these things, and as a coach, it's very important, especially if you're going to apply it to an athlete, to have an understanding of like what the stress feels like and how the adaptations from training occur, so that if you're programming it for them, it's not negligent. Like, you're not doing it from a place where you don't understand what they're going through. So being exposed to like guys like Dave and Paul and like the Nick, the owner of the gym that I'm at now, and his love for powerlifting and sports performance, it's definitely been huge in shaping me as a coach and my programming.
Ian, we're not going to get away from the fact that you mentioned that you competed in a strongman competition. When I see you and I see images of you online, you don't exactly have the normal body that screams strongman competition. For those who are listening and not seeing, picture if you watch CrossFit, Ian looks a little more like Brent Fikowski than he does a lot of the other guys. So tell us about this strongman.
Yeah. So back in, I don't know what that would have been, when I would have been 19 or 20 years old, I had a friend who was a collegiate football player and his mother passed away. So we ended up deciding, you know, we all had a love for training, and that's where we spent a lot of our time. Like, my friend group spent a lot of our time at the same gym learning how to lift. Great strength coach there in Tom Irving, a little shout out, Quest Personal Training Studio. And we decided that the best way to raise money for the cause would be to set up a strongman competition. And, you know, Tom was huge on getting us into powerlifting, Olympic lifting, and strongman work, like the more unstructured side of strength work, where there's so many variables to account for in dealing with, you know, not a barbell, not a dumbbell, and these non-fixed implements. So it was really awesome. And we had been training for it. So things like tire flips, very heavy farmer's carries, yoke carries, the Atlas stones, all these things. And that kind of spawned into this strongman competition that's gone on for years and years now. But that was my first and only exposure to the sport. I mean, it really does beat you up. And like you said, not really the body type for it, but I really enjoyed it and really learned a lot in preparing for it.
Yeah, I was going to ask if you modified to have a strongman diet while you were doing it. I actually watch a fair amount of strongman, and some of the guys, their diets are absolutely astounding.
Yeah, I mean, at that time, I think I was just eating anything and everything. So
fast forward again, you graduate from university, and as you were saying, you're getting to your fourth year, and it's really preparing you for those first steps outside of the university. So what were your next steps, Ian?
So at that time, I didn't know if I wanted to stay in the collegiate route and pursue that through, you know, various internship opportunities, or whether I wanted to go into the private route. And then I had the opportunity to take up a position as a head strength coach at a gym that was just opening, so an athletic performance center. And the more I talked to the guys that were starting it, the more I thought, like, this could be a really good start. I already have a great base from the summer business of athletes who would really appreciate a new space and not just be training in a high school gym setting. And so I accepted the offer to work privately. And that, you know, proved to be a big change from the collegiate setting where it was very structured, and even a big setting from just working for myself full time. So I'm sure that's something we'll dive into.
And when you first went there, you did hit on the fact that it had a lot of the elements of what you'd picked up in your summer job: marketing, selling, capturing an audience. What type of athletes did you start working with while you were there, Ian?
Yeah, so I brought all my athletes over, which was awesome. And it was a good start and a good familiar start. And then primarily it was soccer, hockey, very heavy in hockey, football. And then the general public side of things, like I said to you, that was kind of where the difficulty came, is I didn't know how to market to that subsection of people. And I didn't even know at the time if I was even interested in doing so. I was so set on just working with athletes. And I thought that might not be something that I wanted to venture into. And now in my current position, years later, it's a subsection of training population that I love working with. But yeah, so primarily those three sports.
So why do you think that you might have had a resistance to working with, let's call it, your everyday Joes?
Yeah, I remember having a conversation with Dave at the time while we were in school on like things like, you know, can you imagine training young kids, or can you imagine just doing one-on-one personal training with somebody who doesn't have a goal, or running group classes at a gym? I think we were so set, or I, sorry, was so set on the science behind strength conditioning and the application to athletes that it almost put me in this position where I thought like, no, that's not for me. I'll let someone else do that. Where I have had some of my most challenging and rewarding programming experiences and coaching experiences working with the general public, especially with the vast array of goals or personal reasons that they're training or things that they're battling through. It's been a really, really rewarding experience to have been able to put my ego aside as I'm just a strength coach, and being comfortable being, I'm a personal trainer. You know, I work with anyone and everyone. So I've kind of pulled back a little bit from the I'm just a strength conditioning coach, and now I'm just a coach.
And when you were talking earlier about working with the young students that had goals of being college athletes, you know, it seemed like a natural progression that you're working with the college athletes, then you're working with students who want to be college athletes, and then you're working with everyday people. And one of the things that may have helped you along the way when we talked about that ability to motivate athletes, I can only imagine that working with everyday people like me or my wife, the ability to motivate is even more important than working with the children that want it to be college athletes.
Yeah, absolutely. You, especially at that level, like when you are working in the setting that we are, unless you're working with teams where you may get the odd individual who really doesn't want to train, really isn't motivated, like there is always some type of buy-in as a team. It's just the team setting is really awesome in producing that. When we get down to like the individual setting, like some of the groups that we offer, when we offer a hockey group currently or at the facility that I was at the time, you know, you're getting all these athletes who are coming in looking for specific training to get to the next level, like you said. So there is some form of motivation already set. In terms of the general public, I mean, I've had people come in that like want to leave within the first 20 minutes of being there. And then you start to see like second week, third week, fourth week, you know, like I really like being here. I'm actually enjoying this. You're getting the emails and the texts after the session being like, you know what, that wasn't actually that bad. And it's like, well, you're the same person in the consult that told me you hate training and you're only here because you know it might be good for you, or because your husband or wife told you that you should, you know, take care of yourself. Or so that's really rewarding. And then, you know, you start to see this almost like obsession evolve, where they want to train more. Hey, can I get an extra session in? So that's really rewarding as a coach. And I think depending on the facility that you're in, and my current facility now, like the community is everything. That's the reason why people keep coming back. Obviously, they enjoy training, but they love the people that they're surrounded by. They love the coaches. You know, we have groups that get together outside of the gym and do things together, go for dinner together, work in business together. So when you create a community and you create a family, you see a lot of positives come out of it. And I think the motivation that was really hard to instill in somebody at the beginning almost becomes seamless and easy.
You talked a bit about teams in there, Ian. And while you were doing this role, you were also the head strength and conditioning coach for a junior A hockey team. Can you tell us a bit about that experience?
Yeah, so we were working with a large number of NCAA CIS at the time. I think it's now called U Sport athletes. So Canadian University, American University athletes, and a ton of junior and OHL level athletes at our facility. And we developed a great relationship with the junior A club within our city. And the coach approached us asking if, you know, we could take on a more integrated approach with his athletes. And I think it's awesome. Like, we do it now at my current facility, and we did it then, where you have these athletes who have a schedule. Some of them are in school, but very rare. Like, most of them have got old enough that they're out of school and they're waiting to go to college. So their days are a little bit unstructured. Like, they could sleep in until 3 o'clock in the afternoon if they wanted, go to practice, eat, go to bed. So what we used to do is kind of front load the training in the morning to get the kids up out of bed, get them moving, get them training. And, you know, then I'd go to the rink with them in the afternoon sometimes, work on warmups, work with specific athletes that had injuries, and prepare them for their season. And that season that I first started working with this club, they were hosting the Canadian Championships. So they had quite an older team, veteran team, and a really, really skilled team. But in terms of training and discipline, I guess, they were struggling a little bit. So this allowed the guys to kind of bond all the time, to be pushed physically, and also really work on the things that not a lot of them would do on their own. So like recovery stuff, game prep stuff. And yeah, it was just a really awesome environment and an awesome first exposure to working with a team outside of the college setting.
And how did they do in the tournament that they hosted in?
I think they came like fourth or fifth, but yeah, they had a really, really talented team. And the big thing about that is, like, tournament aside and wins aside, I think they had, I don't know, 7-8 guys go off to play at the next level. And a couple of them now, you know, I've seen them transition into coaching. I've seen them transition into these leadership roles. So that's been the most rewarding for me.
And it was also at this point in time, though, that you made your next shift, your shift to where you are today. So what prompted that switch in facilities?
Yeah, when I was at Queens in my last year, like I mentioned, Paul O'Need took over. And Paul has been a great mentor to me, almost like a second brother at times. And Paul and Nick, the owner of my current facility, Capital Strength Training Systems, were best friends growing up. So I had reached out to Nick when I was thinking about moving into the private sector originally. And they had just started out in their first year as a business when I got a hold of him. And, you know, he mentioned that they were just starting. They already had three coaches, you know, to keep in touch. So that was my first experience trying to network within the strength conditioning community. And it ended up being an awesome one, because a year later, after putting out lots of content, like coaching content, Instagram, Facebook, writing about client success, athlete success, Nick reached out to me and gave me the opportunity to move to Ottawa and to take on a position coaching alongside him and those three other coaches. And I've now been here 5 years. So it was a good switch.
And over that time, you've grown into the director of performance role, unless that was the role you had when you first started.
No, no. When I first started, I came on with, I don't know, Nick might remember, but 15 or 20 hours. Like, it was very small. It was one of these things like, you know, we really like what you do, and there's some position to work you into our groups, but you're really going to have to create a business for yourself. Which at the time was scary, because I didn't really know anyone in Ottawa, but I believed in the product that they had. I believed in the gym and the community that they had at the time. And I really thought that, you know, I just keep applying these principles and I keep doing what I'm doing, and you know, I can fill a client list. And I did. And then throughout that time and kind of, you know, proving myself and working alongside Nick in a lot of different capacities, whether it was from the performance side or the education component side for our interns, or just the business development side and brainstorming with him, he kind of put me into this position.
And so you effectively, you know, you're an Ontario boy, so Fred Van Fleet, who said, take a bet on yourself. Because for those who aren't listening, you made a pretty big move city-wise to take on this role. And effectively, you bet on yourself being successful in.
Yeah, I mean, it was really tough leaving a lot of these athletes that I had, you know, worked with for 5 years, some of them, like if they were with me from the time that we started the high school business all the way to the private facility. But it was time for a change. The move to a bigger city seemed like a good one. And I just knew that the system and the team that Nick had in place was in line with my thinking and my values. So yeah, I made the switch.
And from what I've seen of the clients you work with at Capital Strength, that's quite different from who you were working with in your previous roles. Can you tell the listeners who you were working with now that you're at Capital Strength?
Yeah, so there's a huge array. I'd say the bulk of my schedule now is primarily one-on-one work. So general public and athletes, and that ranges from national team volleyball players to, I don't know, 70-year-old clients in a rehab setting, kids, it's all over the place. In terms of teams, I'm the head strength conditioning coach for the Ottawa Mavericks Volleyball Club now, which is one of the biggest volleyball clubs in all of Canada. And I think that across the board, if I look at their development of their strength conditioning program, it's far and beyond what anyone is doing in the youth space. So a little pat on the back for our staff, but also that club. I'm also the head strength and conditioning coach for La Cité Collégiale, which is a French college in Ottawa. So their men's and women's volleyball team. Team Ontario Volleyball as well. So myself, Nick, and Alexis, another one of our female trainers here, are the head strength and conditioning coaches for Team Ontario Volleyball, men's and women's. And, you know, I've been presented some cool opportunities where I've been able to work with some different high schools in some capacities like that, and also travel abroad to work with a professional volleyball team in Taiwan. So yeah, big array.
I remember reading some of the stuff about the Taiwanese volleyball team that you were working with. And if I recall correctly, one of the interesting things was one of your ways to reduce the amount of injuries they were having was to suggest that they train less. Am I recalling that correctly?
Yeah, so that was a pretty neat call. Like there was a coach from Canada who was going out there, and when he was over, he just didn't like what he was seeing in terms of the physical development of athletes. He thought there was way too many injuries. He thought that the women were overworked. And he wanted to bring over someone from our facility. So one of the guys that we work with for Team Ontario suggested that Nick or I go over, and Nick needs to run a business here. So he allowed me to go, and it was an awesome, awesome experience. But when I got there, I spent the first two days just observing. I mean, I didn't want to get there and just say, this is wrong, that's wrong. But I just wanted to see, like, what's the typical day for these athletes? Yeah, it was crazy. It was basically like the strongest survive and the weakest kind of just fall off to the side. And when I say like a lot of volume, I'm talking about a typical day was the girls wake up in the morning, they get a workout in, they have a practice, which could be 2 hours long. They train again. Then they have another practice at night, which could be 3 hours long. Then they're also doing promotional stuff for the team because there's the business side of it. Some of them are in school. A lot of them, especially in that league, are also playing for national teams because if they play professionally, they have to play for their country. So yeah, just like a crazy, crazy amount of volume. And I just can't imagine how they could keep up with that year after year. And I think it was showing with a lot of the injuries that they had. So when I got there, just observing for a couple of days, my first week was just trying my best, all the language barrier aside, to communicate the best I could with their strength staff, with their sports medicine staff, and with their coaching staff, and just kind of give them some ideas behind the framework that we provide our athletes and our coaches. So giving them presentations on, you know, programming, injury prevention, or how to deal with a long season, it became really, really important for them. And I think it really shaped how they train. And now that I've kept up with what they're doing, you can see they've kept a lot of the principles that we tried to apply at the time.
The one of the things you were working with them on was sports injury prevention. In your current role, you work alongside your sports therapy staff with injured athletes and non-athletes. Can you tell us what sports therapy staff you work with and how you integrate strength and conditioning regimens into the rehabilitation of the athletes they're working with?
Yeah, so that's kind of something that we pride ourselves on at Capital Strength, is our ability to apply an integrated approach between the sports medicine side of things and the practical strength conditioning side of things. So we have two doctors of chiropractic and one massage therapist who are unbelievable therapists. And what it allows us to do is it allows us to create this network and this integrated approach to rehab where everything is done in-house. So rather than me communicating with a client who comes in and, oh, I think my chiropractor said this, or I think my massage therapist said this, or, you know, my physiotherapist told me, and there's so much broken communication, it just alleviates the back and forth email exchange, broken dialogue between the athlete, the client, and their therapist. So we have this system in place now where if there's an athlete that needs to be taken care of beyond just the gym, we can send them off to our staff here in-house and work on creating the best available plan of action to help that athlete or that client succeed.
Can we dive into some specific examples of some of the successful post-surgery recoveries you've been involved with? For example, whether it's ACL reconstruction, shoulder injuries. Yeah. What are you seeing the most of from the type of athletes you work with? And what are some of the regimens you get them on to get over it?
Yeah, so I've had some pretty crazy ones. I mean, we've dealt with in-house, we've dealt with a few ACL reconstructions. We've dealt with whether it's shoulder or hip labral tears, hip replacements, knee replacements. I even had a bodybuilder who had a bilateral groin tear after competing and tearing it on stage. Yeah, we've had a lot. And then, you know, you get the obvious, like the patellar tendonitis, you get the sprained ankles, all that kind of stuff. For us, in terms of volleyball, the constant repetition of jumping and landing and swinging, we get a lot of patellar tendinopathy. Like I talked about, we get a lot of shoulder issues that come out of it, a lot of ankle sprains, hockey, a lot of shoulders, hips, and groins. Those are our two big areas there in terms of athletes that we deal with. I also deal with a national and world level championship dragon boat team. So rowers, you get a lot of injuries in that sport, and they are masters level athletes. So dealing with athletes that are 50, 60 years old. So that presents some unique injuries and issues. So yeah, that's what we see. And then always trying to, you know, try to keep it in-house as much as we can, but we are very open to working with other therapists. I've worked with and talked to multiple surgeons, therapists, whatever it may be, coaches, to help the athlete along with their rehabs.
When one thinks dragon boating, they don't necessarily think of sport with a high injury rate. So what are some of the injuries that your rowers are seeing?
Huge one, rotator cuff. It's just, especially with that masters athlete, like they're accumulating so much wear and tear on the shoulder. And it's one of these sports that's kind of all one-sided. So like you either paddle just on the right or just on the left really, really heavily. And they are constantly going. Like if they're not on the water for several hours a day, they're pool paddling, they're training. So they're beat up. And some of them, it's just these little nagging issues that have accumulated over time and are now presenting themselves as issues, especially for some of them who are, you know, experiencing the sport for the first time and were just like very athletic and competitive growing up, and through repetition and constant stress are having these issues. But yeah, the rotator cuff being the huge one. So I've dealt with a couple rehabs there for surgeries. Low back, hips really get beat up.
So wear and tear of that repetitive motion.
Yeah, yeah.
That makes sense. So Ian, what we're going to do, we'll dive now into some personal training questions. which I'm sure you get a lot as soon as you tell someone that you're a trainer or a coach. So if you're working with an average Joe or Jane like me, what would be your go-to cycle for maintaining fitness year-round, whether that's building muscle, speed, power?
Yeah, so we have a really awesome program at our gym that we call Capital Crew. And the whole goal of it is to, you know, like I mentioned with the long-term athlete development model, the whole goal is to take people who grew up being used to training and giving them an environment to continue that training. So like we have athletes that are transitioning out of college that are jumping in on these workouts alongside with the 65-year-old in the squat rack next to them. So we're also getting people that are just beginning their fitness journey for the first time ever. So we have a wide array of people. We have a wide array of capabilities and we have a wide array of issues within each class. But what we do is we apply a concurrent model of periodization. So we're looking to apply several motor abilities simultaneously and train them simultaneously within a session. So we're getting power work in every session. We're getting strength work in every session. We're working on developing speed and rate of force development within that power block. And we're getting like our endurance work in, our energy system work in whatever capacity we may decide to program it. We're focusing on big movements and the fundamental movement patterns. So like the squat, hinge, single leg work, push, pull, and some type of core stability work in every session. We are progressively overloading and applying principles of progressive overload in their sessions so that they're seeing progress strength-wise. So increasing load, reps, frequency, training density, whatever it may be, introducing new exercises to them as a form of progressive overload. And then applying different, I guess we'll call them advanced training techniques. So like eccentric overload training, drop sets, rest pause work, all this kind of stuff. But the main goal of it being that when you break down our model, like there's nothing really fluffy in it. It's basic general strength work programmed really well over the course of a year. And then we have fun with like the Metcon days that we provide twice a week. We have fun with like the core work that we do, some of the speed work that we do in the summer. But, you know, we keep things simple. We keep things full body. So every session is like a full body session. And for the average person, it's like, you know, keeping things time friendly. Like you can no longer, for most people, program a 2-hour workout. Like these need to be workouts that we can get done in 45 minutes to an hour. Their full body, it, you know, applies to everyone's busy lifestyles. And it allows us to provide frequency throughout the week. So it's not like you show up on a Monday, you squat, and then you don't tackle your lower body for another week. Like that does not provide anyone any benefit, especially if they're trying to get stronger and just live a healthy lifestyle. Another big thing that we do in these adult classes is like we promote people to lift heavy weights. Like, you know, there's a huge benefit for that. Like muscle size is important. Keeping muscle mass high as we age is very important. Keeping tendon strength is very important to keeping healthy tendons and ligaments. We also preach to lift light weights really fast. So produce power. You cannot, like, as we get older, like that becomes an ability that we start to lose. And it's an ability that athletes lose really, really quickly if they don't focus on it. So a really easy way for us to do it is just, you know, we're going to pull back the weight a little bit, try to move that as fast as possible, whether that's a bar in terms of our conventional lifts, a landmine exercise, sled sprints, sled rows, whatever. And in a limited capacity, like still trying to be athletic if you can and not trying to get into it too quickly, but like simple jumps, simple sprints, simple throws with med balls. So trying to maintain those abilities to improve coordination, improve bone density through like jumping and a little bit higher impact stuff, proprioception and balance work. It's all very important, even as you get old, if you're not a professional athlete, right? Like we see issues with people falling, hurting themselves, and then seeing their lives deteriorate as they're 60, 70, 80 years old. If we can prevent that by providing some small stimulus of it in training, that's huge. And anything that you can have fun doing as you're getting older from a training perspective, like I'm cool with. It doesn't need to be our classes. It doesn't need to be anything with a barbell, anything with a dumbbell, whatever can keep you engaged and keep your consistency of training high and a positive relationship with training, I think is awesome.
You know you're a coach or an athlete when you say the words, "We have fun with our Metcons."
Yeah.
It's not something I think you ever hear the person who comes into the gym say when they're leaving. Wow, that Metcon was fun.
Yeah, and I mean, that's another big thing for us is like from a Metcon perspective, like I love what CrossFit's done for fitness in terms of exposing so many people to it and making these time-based workouts or rep-based workouts really fun for people. And I think it's because people like competition. But what we do is we kind of just scale it back where, you know, let's apply some smart, well-thought-out programming to make our Metcon days as seamless and easily digestible for people across a wide array of people, like I mentioned, where everyone is safe, like the impact and the joint integrity is kept in mind, where we're not programming super high rep snatches, let's say, where the shoulder is getting beat up over and over, and it's probably not a movement that should be programmed for 99% of people. We try to make it safe and fun and inclusive. So that's kind of where the fun quote unquote part comes in.
Yeah, there was a gym that I used to go to, and it was a CrossFit gym, but slowly over time, they evolved away from using that moniker and just ran with School of Fitness. And one of the big things they were noticing was when they were doing purely CrossFit programming, a lot of their athletes were getting injured. And so when they moved to the School of Fitness, they still had, you know, me coming in from the outside, still very CrossFit-like in terms of our workout. But I think it was more based on what you're talking about right now. The ability to do it 3 or 4 days a week, week in, week out for the entire year without injury. And so making sure that the progressions were well-paced and was focused on the full body and the ability to recover, not just do today's workout.
Yeah, that's awesome. I love the name of that gym, by the way. But yeah, that's a big thing for us. It's like, if you come in here, we don't want to put you in a position to get hurt. We don't want to put you in a position where if you train on Monday, you can't come back until the following Monday because you were too sore. So that's where the idea of, like, for us, like preaching coaching over, like, you are a strength coach or you are just a coach rather than you're just a fitness instructor, like that becomes huge for us because that's where we can modify things for people to meet their demands of their body in the most appropriate way possible.
So for you personally, year round, what's your go-to routine? Or are you following a similar routine to what you're programming, or do you have a specific program that you follow year in and year out?
Yeah, it's changed over time. I think when I, like, if I look at the 5 years that I was here, I mean, when I was 25, 26 years old, like my body could handle that volume and I could beat myself up pretty well and recover from it. And slowly over time, some of those training sessions that really looked like a mix of like powerlifting and bodybuilding together, I guess you could say, where like my main strength is kind of front loaded in the workout and then it's just followed by like some high rep accessory work after. I could really get away with just doing anything I wanted and seeing awesome results. But then that proved to be an awesome teaching tool for me because it's like you see as you start to get older, and I don't consider myself old by any means, but what I did when I was 25, I can't do at 31 anymore from a programming perspective. I can still get stronger. I can still have a better body composition, and I believe I will continue to do those things in the next couple of years, but the programming has to evolve as well. So, you know, getting a little bit smarter, learning to appreciate rest days and not vilify them, where it's like, if you need a rest day, you're not training hard enough. It's like, no, your body actually just needs a rest day. Prioritizing food, sleep, stress management, those things have been big for me. And also, like I said, when I started, I was working 20 hours a week. Now I might work 20 hours in 2 days and even more than that. So I've definitely played around with a lot of things, but I find what works best for me is some form of compound movement. I've got away from squatting like bilaterally twice a week. So I used to either front squat, back squat twice a week or more. Now I've gone down to like one squat day and then one day of like heavy single leg work. I just find my lower back and my hips respond a lot better to single leg training. So split squats, hand supported safety bar squats, stuff like that. a lot more dumbbell and kettlebell work for the quote unquote bodybuilding side of my work, and just embracing some stuff that I wouldn't have done 5 years ago. So like getting on an Airdyne or getting on a ski erg, going for a run, implementing mobility work and working on areas that I find are getting beat up over time. So that's kind of, my training's pretty easy now, but it's kind of 4 days a week, maybe five. A lot of it is kind of by myself. And then I'll do kind of one or two fun workouts with my girlfriend. Kind of whatever she decides, which are usually my high rep workouts.
You highlighted a couple things there that I think are probably very important to the listeners as it relates to the ability to be consistent. Because, you know, I think you and I would both say, no matter what you're doing in life, the number one way to be good at it is to be consistent at it. And you highlighted recovery, sleep, diet, mobility. Do you want to tackle each one of those and unpack it for the listener so they know how that can influence positively their ability to stay consistent and to get stronger?
Yeah. So if I look at my journey as a whole, I mean, I never dealt with any injuries, but as I kept to push the envelope and not really focus on these things, maybe for your listeners, they don't know, but like as a strength coach or a personal trainer, especially if you're doing it if you're trying to make a full career out of this, like your days are not the standard 8 to 5 day. You could have days where you start at, and it's not uncommon for us, where you could start at 6 or 7 in the morning and your last group finishes at 10 o'clock at night. So for me, as these little nagging injuries, whether it was just like a little bit of knee pain, issues with my shoulder, and recently like issues with my back were arising, it becomes frustrating. But then you realize, like, if you don't start to prioritize these things and make them a habit, like if you're not blocking some type of training off into your day, it can fall to the wayside. So one for me, it was like looking back at like, what can I do in my work life to create some balance so that my physical side of things and mental side of things is taken into account. So the biggest thing for me was sleep. Like, we know that if you're not sleeping, everything else is like not ruined, but it's very negatively affected. Like, you can see changes in the way that you feel from ingesting food when you've slept well to when you don't. You can see changes in your energy, your mood, your ability to recover, your ability to produce power, to produce adequate strength. All these things stem off of having a good night's sleep. So for me, that became something that was like just a non-negotiable after reading a book on sleep. That was really, really important for me. After that, from the mobility side of things, you can keep doing what you're doing, but at some point or another, tissue responds to stress in a negative or a positive way. And your ability to fall into these bad structural patterns by repeated reps without taking care of yourself becomes something that negatively affects you. So just adding in micro dosing, we'll say, even though I kind of hate that term, but it does apply to this, especially if you're somebody who is resistant to that type of work, adding a little bit of that into your routine becomes a huge positive for you when you can start to move better and your joints feel better. And you don't feel as confined all the time. So that's mobility, sleep. In terms of recovery, like I said, recovery is so multifaceted, but I see so many people who rely on a massage therapist or a chiro or a physio to take care of all these problems for them. But it's like, you see them 1 hour a week, you see us 3 or 4 hours a week. Like, what are you doing with the rest of your time outside of here? So taking some proactive initiative and working on sleep, stress management, you know, active recovery work, going for a daily walk, just get yourself moving and enhance your ability for your body to recover, and obviously eating and hydrating well. So those are really, really important. So there's all these factors outside of training that really push the boundaries of yourself being able to optimize health and performance that not many people think about. A lot of people just think, if I get into the gym 3 hours a week, I'm very healthy. But it's like, if you sit at your desk all day and you do nothing else to take care of your body and your diet is terrible, like you are fairly sedentary and fairly unhealthy, quite frankly. So yeah, it's important to think of those things.
You mentioned going for a daily walk. Do you think that the average person undervalues the benefits you can get from just walking for long distances on a daily basis?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that's a huge thing. Like when I look at myself, we've undergone quite a few lockdowns in Ontario, kind of being a hotspot for COVID. And the more that I sit at my computer doing like virtual calls, virtual personal training, all these things, like this is the first time in my entire life that I've had any type of back pain. When I came back to work, and we've been back to work for 3 weeks now, where I walk on average probably, you know, anywhere from 15 to 20,000 steps a day, my back pain is gone. I haven't changed anything. It's just I am now sitting less. So I think it's huge from a back pain standpoint. I know like Dr. Stuart McGill talks about it all the time and just talks about how even a 10-minute walk daily can really mitigate back pain or certain symptoms of it. I think it's huge from a metabolic standpoint in terms of, you know, if you are somebody that is struggling with weight loss or struggling with, you know, your overall health, I think it's an awesome way to just get yourself moving and to burn calories. It's one of the most undervalued things. And I think it's something that more people, because of COVID, I think I see more people than ever out walking, which is awesome.
When we end this call, my wife wants to go for a walk. So when we're done recording, that's what we're doing. I think to your point, early in COVID with the lockdowns, we started walking every single day as a family. I often wore my weighted vest. It felt like a really good way to get a solid workout in. And then slowly, I think it was when I started going back to the office, the family walks died. And so to your point, that's when I started sitting more. And I felt my fitness definitely deteriorated. So I really value what you're saying there. So when you look forward, where do you think fitness is going next? Whether that's positively, whether it's what trends are we going to see? What are some of the things you see coming in the short, near, and medium term for fitness?
Yeah. If we're looking at, I mean, there's a couple different ways we can take that. But if we are looking at the side of things that I don't like, that I think needs to shift, or there needs to be some more light shed on so we can get away from it. I already mentioned it, but like the whole idea of being a fitness instructor, like we could hire anybody to come in and read our board and just yell out exercises at people and yell out, good job, keep going, whatever. But there is a big difference between being an instructor and being a coach. Being a coach, you know, you are providing tools, you are building relationships, you are building programs, you are providing progressions and regressions. You are auto-regulating on the spot to deal with the number of issues that can come up in a class setting and that you see throughout the day. I would say rarely a day that I have a program set for an athlete or a client and actually stick to that program when they come in. People live lives outside of the gym, and we as coaches need to be aware of that. So I think that's one thing that's really important. The other thing are like all these quick fix trends, like, you know, detox is the overemphasis on supplementation, short-sighted programming, like with no scientific backing, just like, how hard can we make this? How can I drive you into the ground to leave you feeling beat up? Just no educational adherence or protocols. The let's help you lose 30 pounds in 1 month. All these things that are very quick, I think we need to take a longer approach to strength conditioning and to just at the end of the day, especially with the general population, like we need to provide them with a vehicle to make lasting change over a long period of time. And even though it's not as sexy and it doesn't sell from a marketing perspective, like it's okay to tell people like this is going to take a long time, but we will see small improvements over time and those all add up. So that would be something that I like don't really like. I don't really enjoy the power that, let's say, fitness influencers have on people. I think, you know, they're really, really good at marketing. And I think a lot of strength coaches can maybe learn something from them in terms of like selling and connecting with an audience. But I don't always like, you know, their short-sighted approach in dealing with like actual humans. Like you are affecting a person's body when you provide them with X stimulus from your training or diet advice or recovery advice. So I'd love to see that change.
There's a lot to unpack there. Have you ever heard someone describe the difference between a cook and a chef?
No, I'm pretty terrible at both.
You made me think about it when you were talking about instructor versus coach, and a cook is very good at following recipes.
Yeah.
So to your point with an instructor, they can follow what's on the wall. A chef can make a great meal with whatever's
there.
That's
awesome.
And so when that athlete comes into the building, and to your point, they've lived their life, you look at them and you had a plan, but you have to adapt. So that's a coach is equivalent. It just struck a metaphor in my head.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Coaches to a chef like a instructor is to a cook.
I might use that with our interns in our next in-service meeting, actually.
Excellent. Good.
That's awesome.
Back to trends.
Yeah. Let's get away from the negative stuff. The positive stuff, I think you're going to start seeing more of an integration of sports performance modalities and like science-based training protocols put into mainstream and general fitness programs. So like I said, CrossFit's done it really well. All these kind of different gym companies have done it really well in terms of getting large amounts of people together and creating a community. But I think where it's going to go is that you are now going to get the attention that athletes receive and that these collegiate settings receive or professional settings receive. And it's now going to trickle down into general fitness because people now more than ever want to be high performers and really want to take care of their bodies the best way possible. I mean, if I look back to 5 years ago when I started, I would run sessions, I'd get the general questions, but it's like now, like we have clients who know so much about, you know, recovery, anything, powerlifting, Olympic lifting, all these things. So like the education component's out there and people are becoming more and more aware and they want to know more and more and more. So I think you're going to start to see that trickle into the general fitness stream. From there, I just think that education and education platforms offered in gym spaces or virtually are going to be huge. Like we do it with teams. We give, you know, we give mobility seminars, we give nutrition seminars. When it's outside of our scope of practice, we bring in dietitians to run, you know, these weight loss or weight gain competitions. We have our sports med staff lecture on certain things. So I think that you're going to start to see this where you're going to have a lot of different personalities coming into fitness facilities to provide education to clients beyond just a workout. And yeah, I think the other things would just be like the continued emphasis on making like women feel safe and empowered within a training space. Like I see it now more than ever where like our members, our female members are just like, they're incredible. And changing the narrative from like strength training will make you bulky or, you know, all these different things to like, it's awesome to be strong. It's awesome to have muscle.
That is a great fundamental message. The part of what you were saying there really resonated. I think you and I may have talked about this in the past. You may have followed the Hybrid Unlimited team and what they're doing for strength and conditioning and bringing high performance to everyday people. One of the ones that really struck me, and I'm actually a little afraid to even consider trying it, is Matt Frazier, recently retired from CrossFit, and he created his own programming so people can train like him. And I have a feeling I do not want to train like him.
Yeah, to each their own with that one.
Yeah, to your point on recovery, on diet, on food, hearing that man talk about how he won the CrossFit Games 5 years in a row, he took anything that wouldn't contribute to that win out of his life. The amount he slept, what he ate, it was all meticulously planned year-round, which, you know, that can take an incredible toll on a person because he's pretty young right now, if I'm not mistaken, to retire from the sport.
Yeah. And actually, that brings up a really awesome point of things that I would love to see go away. That team at Hybrid Performance, and obviously Matt being like an incredible athlete, and I'm sure from his experience being an incredible coach, especially like with the, you know, Olympic weightlifting background and everything. I think one of the big things that needs to go away is always looking at like, well, if Matt Frazier has a program, or, you know, anybody, like think of the best body, like if Arnold has a program, I need to do those programs. It's like those people have so much control over everything that they're doing because they're doing it professionally. And what happens to a lot of people is they start to try these things or they start to do programs that are beyond the scope of what their body or their mind is capable of handling or their lifestyle, and then they fall off. So that's what I was talking about by like making fitness fun and making things attainable to people. It's like not always just going for an extreme because then you fall off the wagon. Same thing as diets, right? You diet super, totally, super hard, but you've never dieted before and you don't understand the concepts of it. And then you fall off one day and then it becomes two and then it becomes a month. That happens with training. And it's happened to me when I'm overreaching and doing too much for what I currently can do.
What a lot of people underestimate, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, Ian, is a lot of these people, whether they're fitness influencers online, whether they're Steffi Cohen or Matt Frazier, they are genetically gifted freaks. Their bodies and their ability to work at the level they're working at is not normal. Even if I followed that rest cycle, that diet, I wouldn't be able to operate at that level. There's a reason you become the best in the world with whether it's 30 world records or winning the CrossFit Games 5 times. Yes, it's the training. Yes, it's the diet. Yes, it's the recovery. But it's also a level of genetics that the person across from you may not have.
Yeah, I mean, I would completely agree with you. And there will always be those outliers, right? Like there is always someone better than you. And this is actually one of the things that Paul taught me, Oneid, when I was like, when we were talking about powerlifters and people getting into powerlifting, and we were talking about things like, you know, I was asking him and speaking to him about people trying for their first meet, and we're talking about specific individuals and we're talking about weight cuts and we're talking about diet and supplements. And he's just like, man, like none of that matters. He's like, there'll always be someone stronger than you there. And unless your goal at the time is to, you know, get a medal, like, you just need to like put your time in to develop the appreciation and the habits to get into that sport or to get into that shape. Like the idea that you should be focusing on all these small things when you don't even have the major points dialed in, it just like it doesn't really matter. So yeah, to what you said, they are genetic outliers, but they have also put in so much time that like a lot of people can't even imagine. Like it wouldn't even seem reasonable to some people if you tried to explain how much training volume Matt Frazier did through his 5 years, right? Like his days of 8-9 hours of constant training and the amount of food he was eating, it just doesn't even compute for most people.
The other thing you talked about there with focusing on the big things before you focus on the little things, I'll share an analogy that really jumped out at me that some people share at work, because there's a lot of middle-aged people who get into cycling, right? And a lot of them, they get in it, they've been working all these years, they have some money saved up, so they buy the absolutely most incredible bike they can. They focus on all the little details, like the carbon water bottle holders, the clay ceramic derailleurs, everything to shed ounces. And when they relate what they're spending on to the average person, the average person looks them up and down and says, well, why wouldn't you just lose 10 pounds instead of spending $20,000 on all those parts?
Yeah. There's, and we see it all the time. Like we obviously, to be in high level sports, like there is a certain level of financial income that people and parents need to have to be able to compete at those sports. No sport is cheap, but like I've seen people get incredible results out of training, out of dieting, whatever, without fancy supplements, without fancy gym equipment, without even like the access to a lot of food, and just having to like ration like what's going to give me the most bang for my buck if this is the amount of money that I have to spend on groceries for a week. When you do the small things right, or when you do the big things right, and then you do and you focus on those factors that we talked about, like sleep, hydration, eating well, managing your stress day in and day out, like you can get incredible results and then start to focus on all the small things.
And that's something really important. So you mentioned your really high bang for your buck. Let's call it the 80-20 principle. If the listener at home, limited budget, Let's talk diet. What are those key big things that you want them to hear that they can incorporate pretty easily into their everyday life?
Yeah, like focus on getting some type of protein. Like, I think it's all like diet has been made such a complicated topic for so many people with the emergence of, you know, intermittent fasting, keto, this, that. Weight loss, muscle gain aside, it's like focus on getting some type of protein in. I don't care how you do it, meat source, vegetable source, whatever. Obviously, it gets a little bit harder when you're doing it from a plant-based source, but people do it. Like, there are a lot of really, really muscular and really athletic people who do not eat meat. And so I think focusing on your protein consumption and getting that in, making sure to eat your fruits and vegetables. I know, like, people always say that, but the average person, like, if they think back to their day of eating, you probably didn't eat as much as you thought you did. So getting that in, getting the micronutrients and the fiber is all great. Focusing on, you know, the whole demystifying that, like, carbs are a bad thing. It's like, no, carbs drive performance really well. And when implemented well, really work in providing you the energy to train hard, but also recover even harder. So, you know, earning those, if you want to be somebody that's on a lower carb diet, like, that's fine. But we always will instruct people, like, how do you feel if you just implement a little bit higher carbohydrate on your training day to fuel the needs that your body has? And sometimes they feel absolutely incredible. And then, like, water, it's free for us. Like, we're very fortunate, but, like, not drinking your calories. So, you know, with the amount of pop and juice and sugary stuff that we have, we forget how valuable water is and how valuable being hydrated is to performance, your alertness, your energy level. Like, it's very, very important. So yeah, just high protein, carbs planned around workouts and training days, and depending on your style of training, fruits and vegetables, and then just healthy fats.
And don't drink your calories.
Yeah, and just whole, like, the more whole ingredient, like, one ingredient whole foods that you can have, the better. So
something that's really impressed me, Ian, over the last year watching you as I've gotten to know you, is how you've adapted to COVID, to the lockdowns, and how you really started to build out an online presence, including remote coaching. Can you take me through what 2020 was like for you and the Capital Strength team, and how that's been going through the first 2 months of 2021?
Yeah, like, when all of this was starting to happen and unfold, and they announced the first lockdown, it was a scary thing for a lot of us, because it was like your livelihood and your career has basically been stripped from you or put on hold. I remember listening to, like, a podcast, and it was one of the co-founders of Spotify, and he was talking about the effects that it would have on business. And he was talking about, like, how within the, like, first announcement of this, some of, like, the top performing e-commerce sites that, like, he deals with pivoted, like, on the spot. And it was basically like, you can complain that you're put at a halt and that everything is stopped, but so are so many other sectors and jobs. So if you want to just sit around and play victim to it, and, you know, it's super unfortunate, like, your business is going to suffer. But if you can pivot and provide something that can keep your customers engaged, then, you know, you might have a chance to really push through this. And that's what we did. So we had a meeting after the first announcement, and it was like, how can we provide the service that we give to people while they're at home? Because we know, like, a ton of people are staying at home. So, you know, a couple of things that we did was, like, we hosted live videos where we had a coach every morning putting out a workout that you could follow along with virtually. We reached out to personal training clients, offered virtual personal training. We allowed members to take home some equipment in some cases. You know, we even, like, I was even out in snowstorms working, training people individually, like, in parking lots and stuff, because it was all we were allowed to do. But, like, anything we could do to keep the brand alive and to keep offering as much support for those people that have supported us over numerous years was a non-negotiable for us. Having consistent meetings with the staff to make sure that all of our contracts were taken care of, all of our athletes and teams were taken care of, was huge. the social media side of things, like putting out educational content for free to people so that we could keep pushing, you know, our agenda for like, how do we get more and more people into the gym when this lockdown is lifted? Because there will be people searching for it. Like, people are starting to figure out more and more now that like health is important. And then lastly, like, our team had been jumping on educational calls with another gym from the Toronto area and learning from some of the top strength conditioning coaches in American sports, from the collegiate setting to the professional setting, and having like these in-service meetings where they would, you know, talk to us about certain topics or their careers and a lot of like question and answer stuff. So that was incredible for us. So we just kept continuing like marketing, providing for our clients and constantly reaching out and offering. Yeah, and learning.
Excellent. Thank you for that answer. As we start to wrap it up, I want to talk about your desire for continuous learning that I've seen in you, that I've seen in your brother, and that I've seen, and then dig into some questions that I ask all my guests. So growing up, your father was the dean at a Catholic school. Your mother was a controller. Did they instill in you, your brother, and your sister a love of reading? And how did they do that?
Yeah, I think I can't speak for Adam and Caitlin, but for me, they definitely tried to. I was pretty resistant to reading, to be honest, until probably 25, 26 years old. So definitely after school, when I just kind of decided that like there were so many avenues to training besides just programming and like biomechanics, anatomy, all those things that you would expect to learn about in school that aren't covered. So like the coaching side of things, the marketing side of things, the biz development side of things, and like even stuff like mindfulness, meditation, all breathing, all these things. So I started to just dive into it and really ended up enjoying reading audiobooks, podcasts. But my parents were really big on it in terms of like trying to get that ball rolling and also really pushing me throughout school, even from elementary and high school, like really struggled with maths and sciences. And like, I can remember being so upset at my mom for, you know, buying textbooks and trying to teach me this stuff in the summer. And it's just like, this is the last thing that a 14-year-old wants to be doing. But when I look back at it, like definitely something that I'm immensely grateful for, because it definitely instilled like work ethic and seeking alternate resources outside of an institution, basically.
What were some of your best reads in 2020, and what are you looking to tackle in 2021?
Best reads in 2020. I loved Atomic Habits. Like, it's one that I've listened to and read multiple times. The 5-Second Rule by Mel Robbins was huge. Crushing It, Gary Vaynerchuk. Like, I love all Gary's stuff. Even though I know some people don't. From a training standpoint, I reread Triphasic Training by Cal Dietz, which was awesome. And then outside the realm of training, like, I really liked The Power of Moments. Think Like a Monk.
Who was the author of that one?
The Power of Moments. Chip and Dan Heath, I believe.
Okay.
Think Like a Monk, I'm getting through. And actually, the first book that I ever read outside of school, Shoe Dog, I reread it. And that was one that Melanie, my sister-in-law, gave to me.
How's Think Like a Monk so far? That's Jay Shetty?
Yeah, really, really good. And I started reading 10% Happier by Dan Harris. And a lot of very interesting, and they sound so easy. Like, sitting by yourself and being very conscious of what's going well in your life and what's not, and kind of like dimming the noise a little bit, so to speak. Something that's really tough for me, because it's like my mind's constantly going, and you deal with so many clients that are constantly reaching out to you at certain times that it's important to take care of that side of things. So I really like that. And just the idea that, you know, you can become a better person through like listening, not judging, being more accepting of, you know, the hard and annoying things that come in your life, and not lashing out on parents, girlfriend, wife, husband, whatever it may be, because you're having a bad day. It's a neat book, and yeah, I'm reading them at the same time. So I'm kind of seeing the parallel in mindfulness, meditation, and all these things.
Yeah, I'm taking I don't know if I'd talk to you about this one. I'm taking a 2-year course on mindfulness meditation teacher certification process. So whenever anyone talks mindfulness, I'm very intrigued and interested to learn what they're hearing, what they're listening to, what they're practicing. It's such a momentous thing to have in your life, the ability to transform who you are as a person in such simple little ways. And it's not necessarily at work. It's partially at work. I think you become a better colleague, better employee, better manager, better leader. But the benefits outside of work, a better partner, a better son, a better father, a better sibling, those are unparalleled. Ultimately, over time, a better human being.
Absolutely.
When you think about yourself, what's your superpower?
I would say my superpower, that's a tough one. My ability to problem solve. I would say like I'm pretty good at dealing with issues as they come up and trying to find a solution. And if I can't find the solution, I'll find someone else who does, or I'll work with someone else who could help me find a solution to that problem and apply it to work or relationships, or, you know, from a training standpoint to an athlete, or as a colleague standpoint to those that I work with at the gym.
So let's go in the other direction. What's something that you struggle with on a day-to-day basis?
I can't think of a specific in terms of something like currently. I guess two things. Like one was dealing with like the stress at work of constantly, like I said, I mentioned before, like you are dealing with human beings, and you are dealing with people who have a lot of issues outside of just nagging injuries that, you know, as a coach, you are privy to hearing about and that you have to take into account. So the stress of always having to, you know, be mindful of that and to help those people out and to be it. So like where I was going with this is like being like a really good listener and being able to relate to them as a person. Like you at that point, it's like you're almost a friend. You're not so much a coach. So like the stress of work has definitely got to me at certain points, and, you know, a little bit of anxiety at certain times, just like the amount of workload and stuff, because you have to think that like when you go in for your training sessions and your coach has been at the gym for 10 hours throughout the day, 10, 11, 12, you can be here for 14 hours coaching. They didn't just make up your program and stuff like out of nowhere. So there is a lot of work that needs to be done outside of it. So that's something that I've dealt with. And I would say something a little more along the lines of like, just I used to struggle to be a good listener. Like, I think it's something where I was like, this is what we're doing for training, and it works because this, and that doesn't always apply, right? So again, more of the like human interaction side of things is something that I like continuously want to improve on.
Which ties into a lot of the books you're reading that I think are going to help
absolutely.
You there. And it's an excellent route. So if there was one problem that you could solve, what would it be?
One problem. That's a very tough one. You know, I would just love to be part of part of a group of people who are pushing the envelope to provide more insight into how training and just physical activity as a whole promotes a great solution to people's health problems, whether that is physical health, mental health, whatever it may be. The implementation of any form of physical activity across the board has been shown to improve metrics on all these scales. So I think just continuing to be part of the team that I am and pushing the message that we are is very important to me, but also maybe over the course of some time, getting involved in different whether it's an association or charity, whatever that really helps people with that who are struggling from certain illnesses.
Ian, how can our listeners find you?
So on Instagram, it's Ian A for Alexander Perry, and _strength_TS is our work account, and _strength_training_systems as our website, and Facebook, but I'm not really on there, just Ian Perry.
And is there any final word that you want to leave the listeners with that we didn't cover today?
No, I think that was a fun one. Lots of interesting questions, and it was awesome to be a part of your podcast.
Thank you. That was a lot of insight. It was great to have you on, and I'm excited for our listeners to hear this.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on The Pursuit of Learning. Make sure to hit the subscribe button and head over to our website, thepursuitoflearning.com, where you will find our show notes,
transcripts, and more. If you like what you see, sign up for our mailing list. Until next time, your host in learning, Clint Murphy.